I have a friend in the Northern Territory. Her name's Miluma May. She ran for local elections, and she's Larrakia, so she's concerned then and now that they've passed the law to...
To go back on the age 12 for criminal responsibility. That was expected. The more west you go across the country, the worse the classism, the racism, the intersections between them, the worse all the statistical narratives. And for the First Peoples, the hits are manyfold, many times more than for the average Australian and also for other marginalised peoples. But as bad as it gets for others, they have it worse because of the generational sins of the nation where they actually held them back. They didn't allow them a legacy of leaving an improved circumstance for their children, unlike every other Australian. So the First Peoples were denied that, and now we're in the midst of today as a result of that. But the going back on by the Northern Territory on the age of criminal responsibility, when you've got countries like Norway, Sweden, Finland, Greece, where my heritage is from, it's at 15, which is actually above the United Nations recommendation of 14. So it's a line in the sand, and it's always a dubious line in the sand, but it's a line in the sand that needs to be had so we can galvanise what needs to be done for those with the unmet needs who have been left behind from the beginning of life, the majority of them, because most of the incarcerated youth at Don Dale and the Alice Springs Juvenile Detention Facility, the Northern Territory and the other 16 juvenile detention centres across the country, because there are now 18 and 4 more will be built. So we've taken a punitive approach, holding pens, bars. We haven't gone to the beyond bars thing of the Nordic countries, which have got the lowest recidivism rates of juveniles throughout Europe and the world. And in fact, or the Netherlands or Denmark, and the progress that's been made slowly, just in Scotland and Germany, going back to 10, well, it reminds me of North Carolina. They had the age of criminal responsibility at 6, and they've improved on that now. So, well, I was about to say sadly, because it's only been improved to 8, so they've still got a contemporary age of responsibility at 8 years of age. Quite a few states in the United States, which is the mother of all jailers, 1 in 4 of the world's prisoners are in American jails. They're the mother of all jailers. But, you know, you've got quite a few places in the United States that can still criminally keep culpable children as young as 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But I think the highest is actually 12 in California and 11 in Massachusetts. And then you've got now 8 in North Carolina from 6 in 2020. But I don't take the United States as an example of any marker of the progressive... And no one should. They're actually the marker of world's worst policies, world's worst practices. And it's a matter of fact, suffering will always be part of the American imperialism. It'll always be part of living a classist narrative where people are entrenched in being left behind intergenerationally, where the good news stories and the strength-based discourses are a mask for the deficits that they don't want to talk about. There's this whole law that we've got, L-O-R-E, folklore, in effect, where we talk about, it must be a strength-based discourse, we must inspire. That's censorship by omission. That means we don't talk about the deficits, and if we talk about the deficits, we're demonising and stereotyping, and we've sold that to the people through assimilation, homogenisation, or aspiration. And we've gone from the, in my view, America's a nation of desperation. It's a place where the aspirational is a myth. People are indentured and others are in crushing poverty.
And where it's commonplace to laud kids that fundraise with a lemon stand for their own brain surgery and stuff like that.
Yes, I spent a lot of time in the United States. I found it an eerie place to some extent. I used to go through the routes and highways across the country to see the place when I had the opportunity to. I never forget the diners and the amenities when you'd go to in these diners, and even at the road stops. I've never seen walls littered There's hundreds and hundreds of missing people, hundreds and hundreds of missing people. And the poverty that I saw, and even the hospitality, the waiters and the waitresses who had to work for tips, and so on. And it's just an exploitive, imperialist culture where the majority of people are indentured, minimum wage, and below minimum wage. It's wage decrease because it doesn't rise at all. Then it's indexed into all oblivion.
I mean, it's related to the fact that institutionally here in Australia, we're heading down a very similar pathway, and we have a similar legacy that we carry forward through the generations in this country that have disproportionately affected Indigenous people first.
They're not just disproportionately affected them, they're uniquely crushed them with the sins of the nation. They tried to blow them out of all existence. They committed linguicide, trying to kill off languages. They committed cultural imperialism, trying to kill off cultural heritage. They made identity a liability, and they posited assimilation as the only course or recourse generationally for people to lift themselves up, which was the very few. Now we have a small culture of haves, who are First Nations and have-nots, and they're caught up in the bind of leaving their own people behind to get ahead in the mainstream while clinging to their cultural heritage. They're the only ones that can enjoy their cultural heritage because they're living above the poverty line. 40% of First Nations people, the First Peoples of this country, the descendants of the First People, live below the poverty line as opposed to 14% of Australians, all the rest of Australia. That's a 2.5 differential, and almost a 3 differential, which is equivalent or corroborates the horrific suicide rate, which is also 2.5 to 3 differential. And it's a poverty narrative. We try and say it's all sorts of other things. Even in the highest cultural content regions, if you're living below the poverty line, you've got no chance of navigating the two mainstream, the mainstream in your own culture. And even if they've got their culture, they don't have food on the table. They don't have any survival modality. They can't family build with the same opportunities that other Australians are actually living. And there's a fundamental poverty of First Nations people that isn't experienced by other Australians. They live in a crushing poverty where many are overcrowded, and they're taking the burden of the homeless relatives, of homeless friends, of cousins and second cousins, third cousins, fourth cousins, because they're all bonded by that narrative of being left behind. With a quarter of a century ago for many of them, half a century for others, and 3/4 of a century for all of them. At one stage in 1970, there were no descendants of the First Peoples who were doctors in this country. There were no lawyers, there were no entrepreneurs, there were no psychologists, there were no anything whatsoever. What we have now, because of a rapidity of affirmative actions that has dried up and has effectively ended, we've now got 1,500 First Nations people who are lawyers. We've got 400 First Nations people, descendants of the First Peoples, who are doctors, and 300 more on the way. We've got a handful and a growing number from that handful of psychologists. We've got several psychiatrists, and we've got a couple thousand entrepreneurs. But that is in proportion to population in terms of rates to other Australians. They're still a long way behind. And what I'm saying is still a poverty narrative, and many have become entrenched in that poverty, and they can't escape, not just in their generational trauma, they can't escape in generational poverty. And that's what's killing First Nations people, the descendants of the First Peoples, in terms of suicide deaths. And that's what my predominant work has been, suicidality. 1 in 50 Australians, 2% of the Australian population, will die by suicide. The deaths of Australians, 170,000 a year, 3,000 plus are by suicide, so that's 2%. 2%, 1 in 50 thereabouts, or whatever, right? And that's horrifically high. That's horrifically high.
And it's a story you don't hear in the news at all.
It's a story we don't actually want to hear in the news, because we've created all these instruments of state, including Mindframe, which is funded by government and every mind, and they get something to the tune of $30 million to find ways to not talk about suicide. And we should be talking about anything that's in the deficit discourse. It's about principles of proportionality. Yes, have your strength-based discourse, have your protective factors, but do not do away with the deficit discourse, all you're not going to get anything done. You won't galvanise public consciousness by silence. They don't know. And if you don't have public consciousness shifted, you're not going to shift policymakers into that understanding of what is the deficit. And my experience of government is they betray. They will not, anywhere in the world, they will not, unless the media carries out stories, and if it's not in the media, they've got no reason to actually do anything about that. That's the story of humanity the world over, the ages over. And it's the story of this country. We live in a censorship of omission. We live in a very ardent censorship. And the Australian Bureau of Statistics is still a long way to go before they start disaggregating data to the effect that we can actually see what's actually going on with suicide deaths, with poverty, with the reasons for it, and in the correlation, so we can actually incite change. We've got to incite change, and we can't incite change without public knowledge. So I'll give you a couple of statistics. 40% of First Nations people live below the Henderson poverty line, and the majority of them in the lowest quintile of income base, and in a crushing poverty entrenched. But another 20% of First Nations people nationally live in proximity to the poverty line, so that's about 60% that are in relative poverty in this country. 60% of First Nations people here in Western Australia live below the poverty line. 75 to 80% in the Northern Territory. 75 to 80%. The Australian poverty rate is 14 to 15%. It's actually bigger than that, because we consider someone on $500 a week an individual living in poverty. But someone on $600 a week does not live in poverty. That's just rubbish. That's just rubbish. And we consider a family of four, two adults and two children, $960 or $1,000, let's say, a week. You live in below that in poverty. Above that, say $1,001, you're not living in poverty. That's just rubbish. So 40% live below the poverty line, First Nations, 20% in proximity, and then we've got jurisdictions such as Western Australia and Northern Territory at notorious rates, unjustifiable. In Western Australia, we also have a jailing rate of the descendants of the First Peoples amongst the highest in the world, and for males, 1 in 12 males, adult males, First Peoples in Western Australia are in prison right now, here today. That jailing rate is the highest jailing rate for marginalised lens in the world, higher than the American jailing rate of its black Americans, its black American males. And that's a feat that no one should be proud of. 100% in my research and 100% in my experientialism, because I've travelled widely, I've been to more homelands and communities of First Peoples in this country over three decades than most Australians. I've been to 600 communities, and there are 1,200 communities, First Nations, in this country, so I've been to half of them. I was the national coordinator of a Commonwealth Task Force on Suicidality and for the First Peoples, and in the time that I was there, the 2.5 years as an inaugural coordinator, went to 60% of suicide-affected families, the youngest, a 9-year-old death, and responded to many tragedies. Only one person who was First Nations had a tertiary qualification out of the hundreds that I went to. And to get the context of the numbers in terms of suicide toll, at the turn of the century, there were 996 deaths by suicide from 2001 to 2010 at 100 average per year of First Nations people, descendants of the First Peoples, remembering that the First Peoples are 3% of the total population. And that was 1 in 26 deaths of First Nations people in those 10 years, a suicide. And that was, in the Australian rates, 1 in 50. And that they're both horrific, but that's harrowing for First Nations people. Then I helped launch the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Suicide Prevention Evaluation Project with Professor Pat Dudgeon. And from 2014 to 2017, we worked on that. We shone the light. We took on the issues, and we brought out the fact that, you know, the suicide crisis was getting worse. In the last 10 years, we've had almost 2,000 suicides. of First Nations people, 1,970 from 2014 to 2023 in those 10 years, as opposed to 996 from 2001 to 2010. So that's a doubling up. That's a 100% increase. Last year we recorded 275 deaths as opposed to the 100 odd deaths that we were getting every year. And we've now done 5 years in a row at, since 2019 with effectively over 200 of deaths a year, and it's gone up dramatically. So I think it's a humanitarian crisis, and the rate now is 1 in 18 deaths. And it's obviously much higher because there's under-reporting issues. These are the recorded deaths. These are the recorded deaths that the coroner has been satisfied to call it a suicide rather than misadventure or by some other unnatural hand or means.